Welcome to Whiskey Shenanigans. I'm your host, Randy Warren. Whiskey Shenanigans, where we help our listeners experience the world of whiskey, every aspect of life, as if it was accompanied by a glass of bourbon. The sports world on whiskey. Basically every part of life on whiskey. Whiskey Shenanigans is about getting exclusive interviews from Bourbon Row in Kentucky, where we can learn about the secrets that make our favorite bourbons unique. We will get inside the hearts and minds of many distillers and help you understand what and how they are achieving it. Whiskey Shenanigans is about going beyond boring podcasts featuring just tastings. Heck, what do you get out of that anyway? It's about bringing on guests and experiencing the entire world through whiskey. But be warned, if you're diving in and you want to participate in these riveting discussions, you will need to grab a glass or a dram and be prepared to be entertained. Hello, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. Welcome again to another episode of Whiskey Shenanigans. Very excited today to have with me Mark Dettore, or Dettore. How do you say that?
Dettore.
Dettore. Mark Dettore from Dueling Grounds Distillery in Kentucky. So he's in Kentucky today, and I'm in Philadelphia today where the weather is horrible. And I don't know what it's like in Kentucky. But
it's pretty raw. It's pretty cold. Pretty raw right now. Yeah.
Pretty cold. Yeah. Pretty cold. And it's been sleeting most of the day in the Philadelphia area. So lots of fun. Lots of fun with weather and whatnot. But hey, we are having fun at Whiskey Shenanigans, and we're excited to have Mark with us. And he's going to tell us some interesting things about his distillery. And why don't you start with, when did this begin and how did it begin and what made you decide to do this? You're the founder, right?
Yeah, I am. I am the founder and the sole shareholder at the moment. I've been involved in Nashville's music business in one form or another since about 1985. I came to Nashville 40 years ago, and right out of high school, in the late 70s, I kind of got started in the DC area, working with bands and that sort of thing. And so it just became my career. And it's a lovely career. I loved it. I've seen the world, but it's kind of a feast or famine sort of business. And it's one of those kind of things where I always felt like I needed to have something else to sort of fill in the gaps. And, you know, I'm more entrepreneurial. So like having a flexible job or something like that didn't really appeal to me. So I started and played around with a couple different businesses. I got a job as the executive director of a local nonprofit and did that because they were pretty flexible with me. But ultimately, I needed something to do that was my own. You know, I'm in the management side of the music business. So, you know, you may have a job tomorrow, you may not. It's that kind of a business. And I wanted something that I could build. I'd helped a lot of other people build careers, and I wanted something that I could build for myself. And that was kind of the primary reason for going out and searching for new ideas. I was a hobby beer brewer for quite a long time and a whiskey enthusiast. And about 2012, I started becoming aware of the craft movement in distilling. And started gravitated toward it. Made friends with a couple of the early craft distilleries here in Kentucky, MB Rowland and Barrel House, and they were all really helpful in just kind of pointing me in certain directions. I went and checked out their places, and because I'd had a background not only in management but also in the technical side of the road, equipment, things kind of going together, it all felt pretty natural to me. So. And I knew the basics of cooking and fermentation. So I went ahead and got a license. And that was in 2013. I bought a 25-gallon still and started making bourbon, started making whiskey. Well, I started making something. I'm not sure if it was whiskey. But it was, and, you know, for over the course of a couple of years, we've, you know, just fooling around with it, perfected what is my current recipe. And, started with that little 25 gallon still, putting some liquor away. Over the course of a year or two, I think I put away 6 25 gallon barrels. And that was how it kind of started. And then from there, it was just like a, this kind of the way I've always done things. It's just like a systematic, slow growth approach. a little better every year, a little better every year. And then when COVID hit, you know, all my friends in the music business were out of business, and I at least had, you know, alcohol and hand sanitizer and things like that that I could do to keep myself and my people afloat. And it became kind of my lifeline. And that had a, I kind of had a major life event in 2017. I lost a job that was paid very well and one I really enjoyed, but it was time for it to be done. And so I just decided when that was done, I was like, I'm not going back into mining for the next artist or the next talent or the next person to work with. I'm just going to put my attention full on into this. At that point, I already had five years in it. So I was ready to the full-time leap.
So you knew what you were getting into at that point. You were ready to jump in full-time.
Yeah.
So how did it?
I at least had enough confidence at that point that it was a real thing, and that it, you know, I could turn it into something.
How did it become Dueling Grounds?
So in the early 1800s, at an area right located on the border of Kentucky and Tennessee, which is where we sit, along the Cumberland Trace, which is now essentially I-65 going north, there was a little area right on the border that was known as Linkum Pinch, and it was famous for hosting pistol duels. Over 40 documented duels happened there on the grounds at Linkum Pinch. The most famous of which would have been Sam Houston, and then several others. And it probably wouldn't surprise you that most of the duels were between lawyers and politicians.
I assume Sam Houston won, but...
Yeah. And actually, he did not. It was kind of considered a bit... It wasn't necessarily... It was not the intention to kill your opponent. The intention was to draw first blood. As a matter of fact, if you were to kill your opponent outright, you could find yourself up on murder charges. But for the most part, it was generally looked at as self-defense. It was clearly illegal, both in Kentucky and Tennessee, but it was sort of like a wink and a nod to the legal, you know, like a lot of things. And, it wasn't until the Kentucky and Tennessee bar associations got together and issued a proclamation that if any of their lawyers were caught, any members were caught dueling, they would be disbarred. And because of that, the dueling for all practical purposes stop. Now it's even in the Kentucky Constitution. When you take an oath for office, you have to swear that you've never fought a duel or provided weapons for a duel. And that persists to this day.
Well, then there's no way to solve the problem anymore.
Yeah. There are people that think maybe we'd all be a lot more polite if it was still a thing, right? People would be a little less... You wouldn't have people aggravating each other quite as much, I guess.
Yeah, you know, instead of road rage, you could just, you know, say, "I'll meet you in Linkum Pinch, and we'll see who caused the trouble."
Yeah, and there were multiple ways. There was a whole code, the Code Duello. There were multiple ways that people could solve their differences beforehand and answer the challenge in a way that was nonviolent. So, and the bullets, of course, were hand formed. The inn there's a Stagecoach Inn, which still exists there. You can go and take tours. The inn would have had a matched pair of pistols there on site. So it was a completely objective sort of situation. You know, you weren't bringing your pistols to the fight.
Right. Yeah. So it made it hopefully fair, and nobody could mess with your stuff. So everybody had a fair chance.
Yeah.
Imagine if you could turn sideways and aim that pistol, that would give you a little bit of an advantage.
Well, that was the idea. So the whole mythology that people say, you know, is like back to back, 20 paces, turn and fire. That wasn't the way it really worked. The seconds would measure out 10 paces from the center and put a pin or a stick or something down for the combatants, and the combatants would stand at the stick generally sideways. And when the judge said, you know, it would count, you would raise your pistol. And then when they said, you know, fire, you could fire. If you fired before you could fire, it was very likely that the other person's second would shoot you. So there was definitely a whole kind of thing going on there. And it was, if you broke the honor and you won, you still won nothing, you know, really at the end of the day.
Right. Wow. But you could still be dead, you know, winning.
You'd still be dead.
Yeah. Reminds me of something my mother used to tell me when I was a young kid learning to drive. She's like, you know, you may be right. They may be wrong. The other car might have done the wrong thing, but you could still be dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that. You know, you're right. You gotta be careful no matter what.
Well, most definitely.
So your formula. Tell me about your formula. You're 66% corn. Everything is local. Tell me more about this.
Yeah. So for me, it was really important to do a couple of things. It was to be authentic with what I do, and transparent. So I will say that we've never sourced whiskey. We've always made our own whiskey, which meant for 4 years, we didn't have any, for at least the first 2 years, we didn't have any whiskey to sell. And then we had a couple of a young whiskey, and then we finally had 4 year whiskey. First off, it's 66% corn, 22% wheat, and 12% malted barley. Everything we use comes from one farm called Walnut Grove Farm in Shaco, Kentucky. I'm sure all of your viewers have been there. And Shaco is like, from where I'm sitting in my house right now, Shaco is about 15 minutes from here. And the family, the Hoffman family, I've known since I moved to Franklin in the 90s.
Wow.
And everything's grown there on their location. They have a great website if your people want to go and check it out, Walnut Grove Farms. And they grow a non-GMO corn, which they clean to a number one quality. While the non-GMO factor doesn't really matter much to a whiskey, it is good to, I feel important that it's to support it, you know, just to support it. It's red winter wheat and then the barley. The barley is sent to South Fork Malting House in Cynthiana, Kentucky, where it's malted and then comes back down to us. So everything comes from one local location. We used to call it an estate whiskey, but now somebody's trademarked that term, so they're trying to make money off of it, so we can't really say it anymore,
right?
At least on the bottle. The other thing that was really important to me, going back to like why we did the corn and everything, is that I'm going to spend money doing this, and so as much as possible, if I could spend money with my neighbors, that just made sense to me. And they have returned the favor, all of them, everybody I've worked with in that same regard has returned that favor many times by giving me their best price, oftentimes extending me a little extra credit when I needed it, giving me a loaner of some piece of equipment when I needed it. So that was kind of the whole philosophy behind it. We do a sweet mash. When we first started, we really weren't in a position to hold mash over and keep the cycle going long enough that it wouldn't go bad. So it just made sense to go with a sweet mash and a really good rigorous cleaning program. We use a number three char barrel as opposed to a number four. A lot of people like the number four chars. They give it more color. But for me, it's also a little too woody.
Right.
And I like something with a little less wood. I want to be able to taste the underlying grains and not just taste the barrel. Right. So that's the basics. We use a 50. We did 6 25-gallon barrels on that little 25-gallon still. So if you anything about ratios, especially in inefficient ratios like an electric still, you're lucky if you're getting a 10-to-1 ratio on mash to grain to finished product. So to fill a 25-gallon barrel, you're getting 2.5 gallons of product a day. You know, you're doing 10 runs. Chances are, like back in those days, we were only doing one run a week or two runs a week. So it took a year plus to fill 6 barrels.
Wow.
But we had it figured out, and we had confidence in our process when it was all said and done. Eventually, we had ordered, we had to wait for it, but we had ordered a Bain Marie 250-gallon still, got it up and running. And then that was like my everything for a long time. Then eventually, we bought a mash tun, and eventually bought a bigger mash tun. And then here this last year, we just installed a 1,000-gallon stripping still. So right. The old 250-gallon still is still working. It's been my workhorse for the whole time, but now it gets to just do the spirit runs. And so we have a bigger still to do the mash run. So what we, over time, we've gone from 6-day-a-week, 12-hour-a-day runs to now we're down to, we can do everything in 3 days in a week in about 8 hours a day.
Wow.
So we've increased our efficiency quite a bit, which is better for the labor picture. I should say we generally only make about 100 barrels a year to 150 barrels a year, although we have the capacity to make up to 500 barrels easily. Right. But if we get the demand, we can move into that.
Right.
We'd like to be doing more custom work for people. We've done some of that where somebody has an idea that they want to do, but they can't afford to go to the company and order 1,000 barrels or 100 barrels even to get their best deal. You know, we can do something interesting and different for people and do 10 barrels.
Nice.
And if you're starting something small, it's good. And then the other thing was just like going back to the idea that I just felt like I wanted to be able to look people in the eye and say, we made this. And we didn't buy it. We didn't finish it. Not there's anything wrong with people who do source and put it into finishing barrels and do all that kind of stuff, but that's just not us.
That's just not what you wanted to do. You know,
that's just not our business model. Now, that's not to say we wouldn't try in the future, but I doubt I would do it under this label. I would probably do something else, you know?
Right. Now, why did you choose the 22% wheat versus maybe adding some rye in there?
We're a wheat growing state.
Okay. So
again, that emphasis on local, high quality rye. They grow some rye around here, but it's, you know, I don't know that it would be what everybody would think of that they like. And so now, subsequent to this, our farmers that we work with have started importing train car loads of rye into Kentucky and distributing it to distilleries around the state. So I would have an avenue for it should I decide to start doing it. The other reason is when you have a 200-gallon system, you can only get a crank out. If you're lucky, you're busting your butt to get 100 barrels done in a year. You don't have a lot of space or wiggle room to have a lot of mash bills.
Right.
So the idea was let's focus on one thing, do it really well, and try to build our bones on that. And then now with the bigger still and the bigger system, we could potentially look at running, you know, one day or, you know, a couple runs of rye a couple times a year just to get into that business. But again, it'll be 4 years before it comes out. So, right. You know, I'm getting to the point in age now where I'm not sure I still got it in me, but and we've looked at like buying in some stuff and finishing it and doing that kind of stuff as well. Just because we would have a broader palette if we were going to do that.
Yeah.
But again, it wouldn't be under this label. It'd be under a different label.
Have you looked at any finishing techniques that you like?
No, because what is happening for us is that we've got a few people coming to us to do their finishing work. So either they have sourced barrels from somewhere and sourced their finishing barrels and they're bringing them in, and we're getting the chance to let them pay for the R&D basically. So we'll kind of see what we can do, what we like. And then we might start taking another look at it. Like I said, space and bandwidth have been our primary, factors. You know, we're literally working two guys, you know, a full 40 hours a week just to make what we're making, which makes it some pretty expensive whiskey if you think about it. And now with more efficiency on that side of things, we could potentially look at it.
Maybe some sherry or some barrels from cognac or anything like that might be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there's a certain advantage to it because you can get it to the market fairly quickly. You know, you're not having to wait 4 years, 5 years, 6 years to start bringing that product out. It finishes in a matter of months. And there's, you know, I mean, maybe your viewers know this, maybe they don't, but, you know, we've got a bit of a glut of whiskey on the market right now on the commodity side. So there's a lot more 8 year, 9 year, 10 year, 12 year whiskey out there available, which is why you're seeing more of this sort of barrel finished, that kind of stuff. The question I have is, well, what happens when that surplus starts to run out?
Right.
You know, then where do we go? But I think it'll be more than a few years before that happens.
Yeah. I mean, you could take some of yours that's already been 6-8 years and, you know, give it another 6 months.
Yeah. And we're going to just start doing, we're starting to have barrels that are coming in that are older, that we've got, you know, a couple crossing the 7 year line here soon. We've got four that just crossed the 9 year line back in July, and they're actually bottled now. They are coming out. I can't give you an exact date, but I can tell you that by the end of the month, they'll be out.
Nice.
Be out. And that's the last four of the original six that I did.
Right.
We
and right
it
now
Founders
you're working
Club.
Off of just that one mash bill, right? And you've got four bottles behind you that then you're making off of that one mash bill. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the OG here was this, which is the which was a 2 year, okay? So the way we were able to open, a lot of people, you know, everybody has their story, right?
Right.
Got my license in 2013. The state of Kentucky allowed for distilleries to get a full bar license starting in 2016. Not just with our stuff, but with anybody's stuff. So we were able to get a conventional bar license and start buying from distributors. And what we did was we stocked in all the good stuff, like everything we could get our hands on. And it's 2016, so everything's pretty readily available at that point. And we became basically the best bourbon bar in the area, you know, north of Nashville and south of even including Bowling Green. We were by far the best bourbon bar out there. So we started getting our tribe. We started finding people. And eventually people encouraged us. So like, you know, we were given tastings of what we were doing. And people said, we'll put it in a bottle and we'll buy it. So this was the first thing we put out.
Right.
And we definitely got, you can see it's got the number 3 on it. And we definitely got some good reaction from people about it and just some real solid encouragement from the industry.
Right.
So we move forward another couple of years and we bring out, we move that blue label over to a bottled and bond. Change it to a 4, and we got the bottled and bond. So everybody's probably on this podcast is familiar with bottled and bond. And this is our workhorse, right? This is my $55 price point. It's cocktails. For me personally, I like a little lower proof. So if I'm going to drink a little whiskey, maybe get 2 whiskeys, I'll probably drink this, right?
Okay.
Simultaneously, as we did that, we also brought out a single barrel expression, okay? So single barrel at cask strength. So where we have to do a lot of work to get this to be 100 proof, right? We got to add water and blend it. We put 4 barrels together. We're going for consistency. Here, we're going for anything but consistency.
Right.
Remember, we're in an unheated space, uncooled space. At that time, we were we started taking summers off from production. Another advantage of the efficiencies, but we were working, 6 days a week, 52 weeks a year. So we were making whiskey when it was hot. We were making whiskey when it's cold. Different profiles come out of that. They really do. And if more wild yeasts in the summer with faster fermentations, slower, longer fermentations in the winter with better conversion. It's all a matter of the taste buds and what you think is better. But that's what we did for this. And so this we kind of celebrating the difference. So like I tell people, this is color, this is living color, and this is Technicolor. Okay. So then the final label that I have over here is our special reserve.
Okay.
So this is for the older labels, the older stuff, the unusual stuff, the 5-year, the 6-year, the Kentucky Bourbon Festivals, the centennial bottles, barrel 100, barrel 200, that sort of stuff. And right now, we've had a series this year going on of 6-year. We've done 4 double barrel blends, not double oaks, but double barrel, 2 barrels.
Okay.
That we proofed to 110. And basically, we just kind of put them out on this red label as a special edition to kind of see if they would be well received, how if people would, this is the premium product and people would want to buy that. And it's been very successful, so successful that we've just gotten a cola approved for a black label that will be the 6-year. And so that will be a permanent line piece of our lineup will be 6-year black label.
Right. Nice.
And I wish we had some that we could share with it right now, but through the media, AI is good, but it's not that good yet.
Right. Yeah. It's not that good. I can't taste it from Philadelphia.
No.
I'd like
to come to see me.
What's that?
So, and that brings me to the point we are we're relatively widely distributed in Kentucky, Louisville, Lexington. We're starting to get more out into Eastern Kentucky, certainly around Bowling Green and Western Kentucky. We're doing pretty good. I have a good distributor. I know a lot of people don't say that about their distributor, but I really like my guys.
Yeah.
First off, it was kind of like, the saying, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. Well, I figure if you can make it in whiskey in Kentucky, you've probably done something.
Yeah.
So I figured, let's climb the hardest mountain and let's see what we got. And it's been very rewarding. We get a lot of positive feedback from people. There's a lot of people that come to see us at festivals who have our whiskey or are buying it there or have two or three bottles at home already, and they're very familiar with the brand. That's been a big change over the last few years, where there's more recognition of who we are. And then I lost my train of thought there for a second, but just the idea of getting out there and people and getting them to know us. And then beyond Kentucky, we work with a company called Bottle Nexus. And Bottle Nexus, you may be familiar with, they work through a distributor. So we sell to a distributor, and then the distributor sells to retail partners of Bottle Nexus, who then have the licenses and so forth to deliver the product to people. So people who are watching this can go on my website, and right off the website, buy a bottle that you'll see. It says right there, fulfilled by third-party retailers, and they'll ship it to you.
Right. Oh, it's fantastic. So we can all get some.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. Yeah. I love what you said about, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. Hey, if you're in the whiskey business and you've got people in Kentucky that are wanting to drink your whiskey, your bourbon, that's saying something, because you're competing with everybody.
Yeah. But we're going to always be the underdogs, and I'm fine in that position. I don't mind in the least.
That's great. That's great. So let's let our viewers know a little bit about you, right? So a couple of, questions about you personally. Like, in baseball, for example, when the batter steps to the plate, they have like a walk-up song. When you walk into a room or you go to the Kentucky Bourbon Festival and you walk in, what's in your mind? What's going through your head? What's that walk-up song?
I don't know if I have a walk-up song. Usually it's like, how much time do I have to set up, and how far is it to the tent, and what do I got to do, and all that kind of stuff. So when I first started in the music business, I was a road guy, right? I was on the road, and my gig was to get whatever was in that truck onto that stage and set up and working. And so I kind of bring the same mentality to this. So I've been basically doing loadouts and load-ins my entire life,
right?
My entire adult life. And so I'm a meticulous planner. Like, I set the whole booth up in the warehouse before it ever leaves, so I can look and make sure I've got every little thing. And then I pack everything in bins and everything's marked. And anybody that's going out to set up with me, they've learned not to just start setting stuff up, because I'm going to make, hold on a second. So I'm very organized in that regard. My problem, I'm generally pretty organized. My problem is I have too many things going on at once.
Yeah.
That's just, at any small business person can appreciate that. You're wearing so many hats,
Absolutely.
In the process of it. Yeah. But I'm very focused. And then musically, because of my background, I'm all over the board. I mean, there's no telling what I'll be listening to.
No telling, huh? All right.
No telling.
What did people close to you, like, do you have a wife or a family? Parents, whatever. What did they say when you told them you were going into this business? They think you were crazy?
Well, I'm very lucky. Oh, no, I'm very lucky. My wife was on the journey with me. She went and went to the other craft distilleries with me, made all the trips. We had all those conversations together. And as I jumped into it, she was there to help me. And then, she had a business of her own. She's a very entrepreneurial person herself and grew up in that kind of a family. As would happen, like 2 years ago, she came back and actually joined the company full time as an employee, and is now, actively participating in a lot of our marketing, a lot of our campaigns. And we were at a point where we could actually, have her have a full time job. So that's been really cool. My mom and my sisters have, watch me do a lot of things. The music business is a very entrepreneurial business, and so I think they had pretty high confidence. But this business is not without its challenges. I mean, let's be honest, it's not without its challenges, especially right now. But we're enjoying it, and I'll keep fighting as long as I can.
Absolutely, I think every business is. I've had a few myself, and I think every business is good in a different way. It has its challenges in different ways. But, you no matter what it is, you got to work hard at it or else it's not going to happen. Yep. I mean, success doesn't just fall in your lap. You got to work at it. That's something I found. But like, let's say you're traveling outside of the area where your product is distributed and you're in the mood for a bourbon. and you saunter into the bar and they got a nice, you know, 600 bottle selection, and you, which one are you going to pick?
Oh, wow. First, I would probably, if I had that kind of selection, I would peruse the bar for craft distilleries. I probably wouldn't go to a brand name. They're all fine. Everything's good, but I want to see what my brethren are doing out there. Yeah. Right. And then I'm going to look pretty closely at the bottle to make sure it says distilled and bottled by, because if it's sourced, I'm not really that interested in it. And I want to see that there's somebody like me on the other side. And then that's that person I want to support and I want to try their stuff. So, you know, I would do that. It, you know, a lot of times within Kentucky it would be like Yellowstone or MB Roland, Barrel House, Wilderness Trail. I mean, I will say the guys at Wilderness Trail were like early supporters and hands-on mentors for us. We still buy our yeast and enzymes from Firm Solutions. We store our barrels at Wilderness Trail, Warehouse B, Wilderness Trail, right when you pull in a driveway. It's on the left side. Right. I know exactly where in the warehouse my barrels are sitting. And even through the acquisition and Campari and everything, they've been really good to work with. The culture's similar, different a little bit, but similar. And I watched that place get built. You know, I mean, I was there when they built the first bit of it. So I watched it get built. I used to go to, you know, their old place back in the day and buy enzymes. And I took my, fermentation class from Pat Heist. So that was cool. And then if I go into a place now where there's not 600 bottles, which I think that's what am I looking for?
Right. Okay.
I tend to gravitate toward Old Forester 100.
Okay.
Solid, generally available, you know, easy sipper. If you can't fly home, you don't feel so bad leaving a little bit of in the hotel room for the maid. You know, but if I just want to have something in the room or at the campsite or whatever, and you know, you're somewhere where there's not a big selection, I'll look at that. And then, you know, like commodity alcohol, a Woodford, is another favorite.
Yep.
I'll go for
those. Those are ones you might put in a flask if you were going somewhere where they didn't have any whiskey. Like, let's say you're going to a wedding and you know that they're only going to have, you know, I don't know, Tennessee whiskey. And you go, well, you know, maybe I put a little in my pocket here, you know, little Woodford in here, little Wilderness Trail, a little something like that.
Yeah. Well, one thing, you know, is Wilderness Trail, I look for a lot. I like their stuff. And our mash bills are kind of similar, which we did not know until like we compared notes years later. And we're like, really? Oh, okay. We're points of difference from each other. But one of the things you learn as a distiller, if you're invited to something where you're driving, you're probably bringing, somebody's probably, they're hoping you're bringing a bottle.
Yeah. For sure.
Because I get invited to a wedding, I'm probably bringing a bottle.
It, you know, you're a craft distiller. So, you know, you may not have a multi-million dollar marketing budget, right? But if you could... If you could get one actor or actress to promote your stuff, who do you think about? Who would be your dream person?
Oh, I like people that play like really authentic characters. Like, remember Timothy Oliphant from Justified?
Yeah.
I like him a lot. I liked a lot of stuff that he's been in. You know, Billy Bob, those kind of characters, those kind of rough around the edges kind of guys I sort of identify with.
Yep.
Grumpy guys.
It's
like
interesting right now with the Landman stuff. I think that's really great, really great stuff, and I'm enjoying that series. And they brought on Sam Elliott now, who
we've been watching.
He would be my guy. Like,
sure.
If I had somebody to advertise Whiskey Shenanigans to the world or tell the world about it, that deep rich voice, I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
He would be the guy that I would
definitely pick. But somebody like that, or and then I think of I can't really I don't it's kind of crazy I don't watch much TV right? I don't have time. So I watch a show, I'll vector in on one show for a little while and I'll watch it. I'll move on. Right. And then I watch the news and that's about it. But the rest of the time I'm either at the shop or sitting here at the computer working. So I don't get to go to many movies or that kind of stuff much anymore, but someday maybe.
Yep. So, all right. If you, another question, like if your personality was a bourbon, what would be the tasting notes?
Oh, sweet and wonderful. I would be probably a little volatile, maybe. Can be very nice, can be very annoying, can be a little bit pushy at times, but you know, a businessman, right? Small businessman. But maybe I hope that the people that work for me and work around me, my wife included in her official capacity, find me to be a good leader and a hard worker, like not somebody who's just kind of trudging along. And so that can come, I think, you know, your tasting notes might be a little bit of like honesty, but you taste the grain, honestly, I think if I was a whiskey tasting notes, it's probably, you know, because it's like that's me, right? That's the way I make things. That's the way I did it. And I didn't take any shortcuts. I don't have any problem. I understand why column stills are important to the health of the industry, but that I didn't do that, you know, and I was told by many people I should, but I didn't, you know, and I know I can make a lot more than I make, but that's not really what I wanted to do. So
yeah.
Hopefully that comes through in the product.
So you mentioned early on that there's a bit of a whiskey glut going on right now, and it does seem that way. So many people got into the craft distilling business and, you know, whatever, and just in this business in general. And, you know, I would imagine, I'm not a distiller, but I would imagine everybody's fighting for shelf space. Everybody's fighting for, you know, mind space so people can remember you and can think about, you know, what your whiskey is and all that sort of stuff. What does that mean to you? Where do you see this industry going? I mean, is it going to get better? Is it going to get worse before it gets better? What do you think?
I think it'll get better. Yeah, I think it'll get better. I think there's a bit of a correction going on, but I think that it's hard for the craft distillers because any little wrinkle in the force affects us in a big way, right? So there is less shelf space. There's less shelf space because there's a lot more product out there that is, how do I put this politely? There's, going back to your earlier question, there's a lot of products with star or celebrity names on it that take up a lot of shelf space. They just take up real estate. The consumer, I've noticed in the last year or so, has seemed to gravitate, like the whole message of it being authentic and made by us and not sourced was very important for a while. I'm not sure if it is as important today, which means I have to shift my dynamic as to how I compete.
Right.
So those, I think, are challenges. I think that there's a couple big challenges. One is that when things were booming, the big guys who had lots of money built massive plants, doubled and tripled their output. So now they could, and then started making a lot of whiskey and putting that whiskey away and sort of overproduced for the market. Like instead of sitting down and saying, you know, let's keep this just on the throttle of where we want to be, what do our numbers need to be to keep our company afloat? It was like, no, let's build. This is part of having national or international conglomerates owning these labels, right? So, oh, we got too much whiskey. We'll just make up a new label, right? We'll just come up with something. It'll make a low-end label, a high-end label, whatever. So there's that. You know, it shows itself in the ways of like insane over-the-top packaging, crazy names being added to things, and ultra old age statements being finished in strange packaging or strange barrels. We're doing some of that work on contract. And what we're finding is we're opening 12, 13 year old barrels of whiskey and we're looking at 60% evaporation, 70% evaporation. So I think a lot of those older ones are going to have to be blended to something to have any kind of longevity. And over time, they're going to work their way through, right? So I think the industry has figured, that's why I say I think it'll get better. But I think the industry has been smart enough to go, okay, the big industries, like, we're slowing down our production, we're slowing down our, you know, things. So we're, I'll be very concrete and transparent with you. This is where it's affected us. Our gift shop business has remained within 5% of last year, right? So people coming in, people doing things. We're good at pivoting. We added a full kitchen food service about 2 years ago, coming out of COVID. And then we were just doing it for the weekends this last year. We really put a push on we serve pizza, pretzels, that kind of stuff. And that's really, that's shot up. And what happens is people hang out, right? And they have a couple drinks and they have, my cocktail business is solid and my bottle sales business is solid. Where we are struggling and where all of us are struggling is in sales through distribution to retail, you know, through distribution to retail, and then wholesale contract type business. I had a steady contract customer who, you know, basically canceled the PO halfway through. And, you know, I'd already made plans to make this guy, you know, a bunch more barrels and was going to carry me through last year. And it just ended. It was over. So that business, that side of my business is 60, 70% down. So you figure out how to pivot, right? You pivot by partnering with Bottle Nexus. You pivot by opening another tasting room. In Kentucky, you can have, you know, two tasting rooms now. State of Kentucky, the legislature, the Distillers Association is going to work with the legislature to try to get us additional offsite tasting rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we could potentially have two or three or four around the state. And that's a good business model because tourists still come here for bourbon. The tariffs have created some challenges because if the whiskey's not leaving the country and it's aged, it's got to go somewhere, it's going on the shelf. And so that's the other thing that's kind of, the tariffs are pushing the wholesale price of whiskey down because they've got to sell it somewhere. Otherwise, it's just going to sit there. It's not a forever thing. You've got to do something with it at a certain point in time. We've opened a few 20-year-old barrels and see, you know, for customers and seen like, you know, 15, 20 bottles in there if we were lucky.
Wow.
And so, you know, and they're paying a lot of money for it. So that side of the equation, I just don't think is sustainable. But eventually, you know, international trade will work its way back around and we'll be fine. And then the big boys will be exporting. We don't really export, but the big boys will be exporting. That'll open up more shelf space. I feel like a lot of the consumer moves too. Like, what does the consumer want? Right now, the consumer's into the idea of older age statements and barrel finishes because they're available. But what's going to be next? You know, what will be the next thing? There's always going to be a next thing. And we're kind of trying to pay attention to that. And then, but my business has always been, direct to consumer has always been the primary part of my business. And that piece of it has definitely still been good. Next year, you know, we're paying attention to, we have the Winter Olympics coming up. So there's a reason to celebrate. People go out to drink and hang out and watch games. America's 250th birthday is coming up in July. I predict a lot of people will be on the road doing road trips, going to national parks. Our new store is in the shadow of Mammoth Cave National Park. And then the World Cup, you know, they're predicting millions and millions of people coming from all over the world for that period of time from mid-June to mid-July. So I think we'll probably see some heavy upticks in those months. So I think June and July, and we're concentrating on what kind of specials can we run? What can we do? What can we market? What little hooks can we come up with? Because there'll be, you know, if you're going to Atlanta for a game and you're going to Boston for a game, there's a pretty good chance you might come through Kentucky and do you know, a few days of a bourbon trail.
Right. That's awesome. Yeah, I actually got my hands on a 20-year-old Widow Jane not too long ago. And I was talking to my son, too, about, he's getting married in June, at the end of June. And I'm like, hey, let's take a cool trip. We could go to the Bourbon Trail, or, you know, we were talking about maybe going to see some World Cup games. And the U.S. is playing, it looks like it's all out on the West Coast for the U.S., at least in the the initial stages of the World Cup. Assuming they get past that, then it could be anywhere. But two games are in SoFi Stadium in LA and stuff like that. So, you know, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of things coming up, a lot of good events coming up. But tell us a little bit more about Cave City, Kentucky, and your new tasting room. How did that come into being?
So I started, you know, Cave, for a point of reference, Mammoth Cave National Park is located in central Kentucky, gets about 6 million visitors a year to the area. People come for the park. They come for other private caves. They generally spend a few days in the area. A lot of people camp. You're within about 15 minutes of the Corvette Museum in Bowling Green. So there's a lot of different things to do. So we'll get, and they have a kind of tourist season that runs roughly, you know, I'm told April through, it feels we're kind of tapping out on it now, about mid-November. It is a town that was basically built as a tourist town.
Okay.
To welcome visitors back in the, you know, back into the 19th century, where people would come into Cave City, they would buy their tickets and load up on wagons and be taken up to the cave before it was even a national park. Once the national park came into play, and they had visitor centers up there, you had an interstate running by Cave City, like a lot of those kind of places started to decline. Kind of like a typical Route 66 town, you know, it sort of had really cool, kitschy stuff of a certain era, but eventually started to decline. There's Wigwam Village. You can go stay in a wigwam. People cool. Love it. There's Dinosaur World, recently made famous by Tyler Childers by doing a concert there. Just a lot of kind of fun stuff like that. Family stuff, right? It was dry for years. And then a bar opened up there called The Dive. And a lady named Letitia Klein, she grew up in Cave City, had gone on to have a career as a model and sports commentator, big time into motorsports. She came back to Cave City and started this bar and as a way to help bring some economic development to her city. And in the downtown area was like a lot of downtowns at the time. You know, there was this mixture of antique stores and boarded up storefronts, and that was about it. So she started this place called The Dive, and through a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, really got it established, got herself on city council, got some changes started, then bought another building and opened a coffee shop, which I thought was brilliant, you know. So I would go up there and sell alcohol to her and visit with her as it was coming along. And I always just kind of paid attention to it. So I was like, the idea of being in a tourist town,
yeah,
where like right now our place is, it's a destination. You have to be coming there to see us. You're not just, maybe you're going to drive by, but more often than not, I have people say, oh, I drove out here 100 times before I finally decided to stop in, right? But up there, you've got people wandering the streets looking for stuff to do. So through Letitia, I connected with a friend in Bowling Green who, unbeknownst to me, had a storefront up there that he was going to renovate. So we reconnected and started talking about it. And he basically said, I would really like to see you guys here. And, you know, what do I have to do to make that happen? And so he cut us a good deal. And he had two storefronts. And I went ahead and I signed the lease on both storefronts. And I said, you know, if I can't accomplish what I want to accomplish here, I'll just rent them both. But what I really want to do is get another distillery to come in with me. And I went through two or three distilleries who were interested, but M.B. Rowland out of Pembroke, Hopkinsville, finally came in and took over the second storefront. So now there's two of us right next to each other. So you've got us and M.B. Rowland. And our place is kind of very barrel themed, very traditional, got a lot of barrel staves and a live edge oak bar. And it has, you know, it's really nice. And then their place is got kind of a New Orleans theme. So through this, I was also talking to a gentleman named Luke Jean, who has a company called Balance Distilling out of Smiths Grove, Kentucky. And he was in a small location, family farm, you know, way off the beaten track. And he had been on a kind of simul track looking at Cave City through the mayor and through a couple others. And he got access to a property about 3/4 of a mile away from us, right off the interstate. Borders right up to the interstate. It's 11 acres. And he's moving his whole operation there.
Wow.
So we'll have a fully functional craft distillery. And then less than 3/4 of a mile away, we'll have two tasting rooms for two different well-known craft distillers. Paul is the second oldest craft distiller in the state of Kentucky. I'm probably the fifth, you know, at this point. And so you got two well-established businesses making good, solid product, good, solid product lines. And then a true craft distiller making very interesting products. Luke really likes to make rum, which I think is cool. So that'll give us something different. We'll have distillery tour. He'll have patio areas and stuff like that. The city has been great. The city closed off a street for us between my building and another restaurant. I should give a shout out. There's a couple of landowners that came in from out of town, but one out of Bowling Green, one out of Frankfort, who bought these properties and then basically recruited us. You know, went to retail outlets. So the gentleman out of Frankfort, he went and recruited a company called Porter's Tap Room, and they have a store in Frankfort. And Jonathan, who runs Porter's, he set up a second store down there. He's got a full bar restaurant. And from what I can see, he's busy all the time. I mean, he's really busy.
Wow.
So it seems to be, and he's right next to me. So in the span of a couple of months, 4 empty storefronts got filled and opened. So this is the kind of growth that the city's really happy about. And we're actually having our ribbon cutting a week from Friday on the 12th down there. So if anybody's listening to this or seeing this, I don't know when this is going to air, but 12 o'clock on Friday the 12th, we're going to cut a ribbon. We're going to have some special bottle offerings. We're going to do some tastings and some cocktails and celebrate doing this. But my vision of it is that we're right off of I-65. It's a easy, less than an hour haul down from E-Town, Elizabethtown. It's an hour from Bardstown. It's an hour and 15 minutes from Louisville. A lot of times it's a struggle to get people who come in for the Bourbon Triangle to come south, right? So this, we're hoping with 3 of us, maybe eventually 4 or even 5 of us, we create an environment where people would come there and actually maybe stay a day or two there just to do us.
Right.
And then that becomes a thing. So my hope is it grows bigger than what we can make it.
Right.
And that outside investment comes in. We'd love to see a winery or a brewery or something come in. And then the city, for its part, has designated the entire 3 or 4 block area as an entertainment district. So we have the ability to close the streets. We have specially made cups where people can get a drink in one place, and maybe there's a music festival going on. They can take it outside. They can watch the show, or they can wander into another place with that same cup. And so it's the idea. It truly puts us in a situation where we all will do better if we work together.
Absolutely.
And that's the whole point, right? So nobody's an island. Everybody, all of us, like MB Roland and us and Balance, we're all in great locations. We love it, but we're all like, you have to be specifically going there. There's no foot traffic, nobody wandering by. So, it's a chance to sort of, you know.
Fantastic. It's going to work. I know it does, because I've did a couple episodes ago with St. Augustine Distillers down in Florida. And I visited them, and I mean, they get most of their revenue from people who come to visit. It's a beach town. It's a destination town. It's one of the oldest towns in America. It's got a lot going on, and they've got tons of visitors. And just so happens, coincidentally, that there's a little trolley that goes around town and stops at all the interesting places, stops right at Mike's store, and drops off anybody who wants to go on a distillery tour. And they do a bang up business with that. So it's definitely a smart idea to do what you're doing. And, you know, I hope it's going to be tremendously successful for you guys.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We took a look at, like, you know, Gatlinburg, Old Smoky is the most visited distillery in the world. They do, just at Old Smoky, they do more visitors than the entire Kentucky Bourbon Trail.
Wow.
I don't know.
Just because of where it's located.
Because of where it's located, right there, and because they have a product that is very accessible to the consumer. There's not many other places where moonshine sells really well, but by God, in Eastern Kentucky, it does, and Eastern Tennessee. And so in Central Kentucky, where we are, you know, people are coming from all over the world. And what are we known for? Well, known for bourbon, right? Yeah. So let's give them a bourbon experience. And we can each have a piece of that bourbon experience and not be expected to sort of have to try to do it all.
Right. That's perfect. Love it. Well, thank you very much for your time today. This has been really enlightening, and I can't wait to get my hands on a bottle and give it a tasting. I like to do tastings on Whiskey Shenanigans, put them out on Instagram and whatnot and that sort of thing. And we will, of course, give you clips of all of this interview and all of our discussions and everything like that. You can use those for your social media, and we'll use them for ours, and we'll share the benefit.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. I enjoyed this. It was fun.
Yeah, it has been very fun. It's great getting to know you. And you said that the Cave ribbon cutting will be December 12th?
December 12th at noon. And we're in Central Time.
Okay. That's my birthday. It's only a week away, though, almost. Phew. Got to get out there. I would love to come out and visit.
That sounds like
a great time.
You bet.
So thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll see you soon.
All right. I'll be in touch. Bye. All right. Whiskey Shenanigans fans. Wow. The most surprising things that happened in sports this weekend. Oh, man. Can you believe it actually didn't happen this weekend? It happened today. Mike Tomlin resigned. Now, the press, they don't understand. The national press, all these people, they're like, Mike Tomlin is the greatest coach. You know, he never had a losing season. And, you know, someone said that Steelers fans don't understand. Steelers fans don't know what they've lost. I disagree vehemently. I sit in the stands with the other fans. I watch the games. I'm there, you know, for every home game for the past 20 years. And got to tell you that being mediocre is not a blessing. It's a curse. And that's what we've been for a long time. We haven't won a playoff game since 2016. So that's 10 years. Okay. We haven't had a quarterback for the last 4 years since Ben Roethlisberger retired. We've tried a few things. We're filling in quarterbacks here and there. Aaron Rodgers was a nice possible fill-in. You know, we drafted Kenny Pickett. He was a nice possible decent quarterback. We drafted a pretty decent kid who's Will Howard, who's sitting on the bench and hasn't even had a chance to get in a game yet, which is fine. I understand that. I mean, you know, you're going to play Aaron Rodgers because you have him. And he should clearly be better than Will Howard, but Will Howard is, I believe, a Heisman Trophy winner, and he won a national championship at Ohio State his senior year. The kid is pretty good. Fell to the sixth round for the Steelers. Is he their future? Probably not, but you don't know that. You haven't tried yet. I'm excited to see the kid try. I'm excited to see the Steelers draft a new quarterback next year. They need a new quarterback. They're going to obviously need a new head coach without Mike Tomlin. And what a great job. Wouldn't any head coach in the NFL like to get out of their current contract, or maybe is available now, and go interview for the Steelers job? You could be the Steelers head coach for the next 20 years. That's a good gig. The Steelers ownership is very loyal. They don't just, you know, change coaches like you change your underwear. You know, some of these teams have had so many head coaches while Mike Tomlin has remained in Pittsburgh all these years. And he's been great. He's been great. But that's part of the problem. When you're successful, but only modestly successful, mediocre successful, you end up drafting mediocre players, and you get more and more mediocre every year. So you're drafting in the 20s, 22nd position, 24th, 26th position. This year we made it to the playoffs, which was wonderful. Oh my goodness. To beat Baltimore, you know, the last great victory of Mike Tomlin's career, beating Baltimore. Nothing better than that for a Steelers fan. You know what I'm saying? Fantastic. But being mediocre is not a blessing. You draft low. You don't get an opportunity to pick a great quarterback. None of the top quarterbacks are going to be available at 26. It's not going to happen. You need a top five, maybe even a top three pick in order to really get a top-notch player, a top-notch quarterback. Where's the next Troy Polamalu going to come from on defense? The next TJ Watt? Where's the next Ben Roethlisberger going to come from? When's the next Hall of Fame quarterback? And I know they don't fall out of trees, but hey, let's look at some programs that have been successful. Green Bay has been successful with three straight quarterbacks that are probably all going to play longer than a decade for the Green Bay Packers. That's a great gig, man. You got to develop those kind of that kind of talent. You got to develop those type of players. And development has probably been the one thing that Mike Tomlin isn't good at. It's kind of like, you know what? Man up. You got to go out there and beat your man. And then he goes in his press conference and he says, well, we didn't, one-on-one, we didn't beat our man today. And we didn't make enough splash plays. And you got to play all three phases of the game. You got to play complementary football. And it's all just, it's all just words. Doesn't mean anything. And you end up being 10 and 7, 9 and 8, whatever, barely over 500, drafting low again, not getting top prospects, not getting the best players while they go off to other programs. I mean, look at how the Patriots have revived themselves after Tom Brady. Sure, they stunk for a while. 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, whatever. They stunk for a while. That was tough for their fans. But look at them now. They got their quarterback. They got a good team. Look at the Bears. They got their quarterback. They got a good team around them. There's a lot of teams that are really succeeding in rebuilding themselves. And this is the time for the Steelers to rebuild themselves. Fact of the matter is, they're going to go after and do exactly what they always do in Pittsburgh. They're going to go find themselves a young coordinator, maybe a defensive coordinator, offensive coordinator, or a young coach of some sort, somewhere, somebody in their 30s. They're not going to, people in the press are like, maybe the Steelers should take Harbaugh. What a joke. What are you, stupid? No, that's not going to happen. Why, is Harbaugh a bad coach? No. He's a great coach, too. He's had a wonderful career in Baltimore. We don't need that. What we need is a young quarterback, a young coach. We need somebody like the guy in Detroit. Look at him. He's basically using advanced analytics to run his team on the field. He's going for it on fourth down. He's not playing so conservatively. The Steelers have lost games and been not a top-notch team because of Mike Tomlin, because they've played conservatively. Mike gets you to the finish line. And then a player, he'll say this himself, a player needs to make a splash play. A player needs to make a big play at the right time. And that player has been TJ Watt of recent years. Make a big play at the right time in the fourth quarter, strip sack or something like that. That's how you win games in Pittsburgh. You keep it close because you really don't have that great of an offense. Let's be honest. We haven't had a quarterback in 4 years. And even Ben's last few years, he wasn't the same player that he was earlier on. Yeah, that's fine. Fabulous Hall of Fame career. We love him. But Steelers fans have had enough of Mike. And it's the conservative nature. We don't need another 24th pick in the draft. We need to trade up. We need to find the right guy. We need to get the right coach, somebody young, somebody aggressive, somebody who's going to play real football and not play super conservative like we've been doing. I mean, in that third or fourth quarter of that game this past weekend against the Texans, who just absolutely dominated the Steelers, we went backwards on at least three or four successive possessions where we actually lost yardage. We didn't even make a gain because we're throwing these little out balls. It's like, what is this garbage? And hey, by the way, The other most craziest thing that happened this weekend, San Francisco beat up on the Philadelphia Eagles. Philadelphia Eagles played horrible. You know what I said? I said they played Tomlin ball. Real conservative. The play calling was, ooh, what is that garbage? Their big wide receiver dropped three balls. And then when the game was on the line, they didn't even go to him. They threw it to their tight end, Goddard, because they couldn't depend on their big wide receivers to make catch. They played awful, and they played conservative. And you know what? These things come down from the top. They come down from the coach. The coach plays conservative, makes conservative play calls, and the team responds. They do what the coach says, and it looks ugly sometimes. And so I've seen it in Pittsburgh. I've seen it in Philadelphia. I've seen it all over the league. Over-conservativeness, if that's a word, it's not. But over-conservativeness will get you nowhere. So these are the most surprising things that happened in sports this weekend. Mike Tomlin, that's a surprising thing. Was it surprising that Harbaugh got fired from Baltimore? Yeah, I guess if you're a Baltimore fan, it was. Yeah, same kind of problem. He'd been there for a long time. Now there's all these job openings. That's great. There's all these job openings. Wonderful. But the Steelers aren't going to be going after any of those coaches. And I don't know that Baltimore's going to go after any of those coaches that are now available either. They might hire Tomlin, but here's a prediction for you. Put this one in the book. Take this one to the bank. Go on to your prediction.org or whatever the betting website that you love to bet on. The Giants will hire Mike Tomlin if he wants to be hired. He may go into broadcasting or something else. He may need a break. 19 years as a head coach, it's a long time. So give the guy a break. He may take some time off. That's cool. But I suspect the Giants really would like to have Mike Tomlin. The Mara family and the Steelers, they're all tight. So that's probably where he'll end up going if he remains a coach. If he doesn't remain a coach, whatever. The Steelers are going to hire somebody young. Who knows what Baltimore's going to do, but it's going to be interesting. And you know what? You want to model yourself right now after the Bears, after the Patriots, after even, I'm even going to throw Detroit in there, because if they didn't have so many injuries, they'd be killing it right now. That's a good football team. So, you know, hey, if I was Mike Tomlin, I'd take that job. That's a good football team, chock full of talent. So we'll see how it goes, but never a dull moment in the NFL, man. It's all happening now. You heard it here. Have a great week, Whiskey Shenanigans.
Yeah, this was the right thing to do. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So let me, I'll get you to that day, which did occur. But I was basically working side project, you know, the distillery, and I was helping more just strategic stuff, still had a full-time job. 2020, you know, we were shut down downtown. We had to make hand sanitizer, which you may be familiar that that's the way some of us survived during that time frame. And that did open our eyes to like, hey, we got to get some scale to this operation. Cause at the time we were putting away 30, 40 barrels. We weren't doing it at enough a scale to where it really could become a business.
Right.
So we looked around the area and we found a piece of land in Midway on which we could build a distillery. So that kicked off a 3-year construction project in which we renovated the house where the visitor center is for the distillery. And then we built the distillery, the first barrel house. But it essentially was just a large project. And I feel that's only been in the past, you know, 3-4 months now that we have the still running, we have our bottling line running, we have a barrel house that's nearly full. We have a lineup of products that I'm super excited about and I feel very good about and enjoy, you know, at the highest levels of And so it's probably been in the past 3 months where all these pieces that we've been working on for years have come to fruition.